Suppose you ask the simple question, what is socialism? It is capitalism's shadow. Socialism and capitalism have always been the institution and its irremovable shadow. Nothing guarantees the future of socialism as much as capitalism. They are each other's twins. Capitalism produced socialism.
That's Richard Wolff, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Richard Wolff on capitalism versus socialism. The great radical historian Howard Zinn once told me, half in jest, that one of the greatest disasters to befall socialism was when the Soviet Union put it in the official name of the country, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. I asked him to explain, and he said, the USSR, which had little to do with socialism, it was an authoritarian state, wanted to capitalize on the almost universal good name that socialism had at that time. And the capitalist countries played along by smearing socialism and conflating it with the USSR. If you expressed interest in socialism, the response would be, why don't you move to a gulag in Siberia? Today, because of growing wealth and income inequality and the Bernie Sanders campaign, he got more than 13 million votes, there is a resurgence of interest in socialism. Many young people are fed up with predatory capitalism and are looking for alternatives. Worker-owned and operated co-ops are springing up. These initiatives can proliferate and grow. And as Howard Zinn always said, authentic socialism must be small d democratic. Our guest today is Richard Wolff. He's professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and he's currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. The New York Times calls him America's most prominent Marxist economist. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy at Work, and a book of interviews I did with him called Occupy the Economy. He spoke in New York. And now, Richard Wolff.
So let's start with capitalism versus socialism. The first thing that I want you to understand is that the interest in socialism, which was, if not dead, close to dead for 50 years, has returned. And nothing captures that so much as the famous line, I think, of Mark Twain. For those of you who don't know, Mark Twain was a native of Hartford, Connecticut. This is important to remember because it's hard for people in Hartford to find much that was important in Hartford. And Mark Twain is certainly right up there with the top. And so he's sitting in his coffee shop, if they had them back then, one morning, and he picks up the Hartford Current, I think it was called then, and it still is, the Hartford Current, and reads in there an obituary of Samuel Clemens, which is his actual name. Mark Twain, not a real name. And he writes a very famous line to the editor of the newspaper, whom he knew, and the line read, "Reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated." Signed, Mark Twain. The death of socialism has been celebrated so many times, it's getting boring. Every time the death of socialism has been announced over the last 150 years, lo and behold, it rears up again like some bad, scary movie in which the dead thing comes to life and frightens you. And so socialism is now coming back in all kinds of ways. The works of socialism, the characters of socialism. I'm going to give you three examples. I could pick up anything. The Atlantic Monthly magazine has one of its contributing editors, a young woman who writes something, and they also make a video, which is on the Atlantic Monthly website. Very nice. She speaks for about 10 minutes, 12 minutes, not very long. And the topic is late capitalism. I kid you not. And she explains that this is a term that has a history that includes Karl Marx. She does a good job of a good history. She's got her information correct. But she's friendly to the whole thing. This is an interesting idea, she says. And she shows that it comes right out of the socialist literature, the Marxist literature. I found that arresting. That's a major magazine in this country, the Atlantic Monthly, and has been for many decades. That's the first thing. The second thing was, which some of you I think noticed, is that I did an appearance on Fox News. I did that. Fox Business News in the morning, Stuart Varney, I believe is the name, Stuart Varney. And there he is, Mr. Varney, who prides himself on being a right-winger, asking me softball-type questions about socialism. Couldn't I tell him why it's growing these days, says Mr. Varney. And there we are, having a conversation about socialism and Marxism. It's kind of interesting. And the third example is that in a number of European countries right now, the latest edition of Karl Marx's Capital is getting close to bestseller status. It's selling huge numbers of copies. So what's going on here is a kind of interesting question. Recent polling here in the United States that indicates people that are 35 and under in the United States, when asked the following question, which do you prefer, capitalism or socialism? A majority now say socialism. Here in the United States, young people. And that's consistent with everything that I see as I travel around the country giving talks. So let's talk a little bit about what all of this means. First, here's what it doesn't mean. It's not really a serious embrace yet of socialism, mostly because there is very little understanding or knowledge about what socialism is. People who are 35 and younger today means they've been in school for the last, whatever it is, 15, 20 years, which means they've been exposed mostly to teachers who don't know anything about it, who even if they knew something are afraid to spend much time at it, and who are super afraid to go into it in a way that might be deemed as positive or friendly or sympathetic. So they just don't know. They just don't know. It's a very serious issue. So what that vote for socialism really means is we don't like what we got, and we know that what we got is capitalism, and we don't like this. So you give us a choice between what we have and something else, we'll go with something else, and then we'll figure out later what that exactly is. If they do know something, what they probably know is a little bit about the Soviet Union or China or Cuba or something like that. And given the sources from which they have gotten that information, most of that information is negative. It's they're dictatorial, they don't have democracy, they are whatever, poor, or whatever negatives have been associated with them. So we're dealing here with a disaffection from capitalism that is massive. It's massive in Europe, it's massive here, and it's pretty strong in many other parts of the world. Stronger than it's been in a long time. But it doesn't know quite where to go, this anti-capitalism, this criticism. It isn't inclined to go towards what it sees as socialism a la Russia, China, Cuba, because it has bad associations with those things, if it knows anything. Certainly those societies have done enough bad things to give it, make it relatively easy to paint them in bad colors, in negative colors. So between what has been said bad about them and what they've done that isn't attractive, this is not where people seem to want to go. There'll always be some, but it's not where the general flow of disaffection from capitalism is taking people. Well, then where is it taking people? Well, it will take them in the direction of a socialism if that socialism tells everybody, we're not the Soviet Union, we're not China, we're not Cuba, we're not any of the bad associations we have. And what the best way to do that is to stick an adjective in front of it that everybody knows is a good one. Therefore, the first choice will be democratic socialism. That's if you can't choose between vanilla and chocolate, you ask at the ice cream store for one scoop of the chocolate. Because that avoids the difficulty. So now we have democratic socialism, and we have here in the United States a major purveyor of that particular move. Actually, two. One is Bernie Sanders, because he's the public figure of democratic socialism. And the other one is the organization Democratic Socialists of America, which is very proudly saying these days that they have exploded in their membership and have 25,000 members across the United States and are therefore the biggest left-wing organization, which is probably true. So we have socialism what? We have socialism light. We have low-cal socialism. But that's not surprising. If you're moving towards that, you want to take it slowly, take it gradually, take it moderately. The important thing is people are going in that direction. We'll see how far they go. There'll be all kinds of struggles about how far they go. But one of the things that has to happen is we have to overcome, and this is a peculiarly difficult problem in the United States, we have to overcome 50 years of silence, 50 years of taboo, 50 years in which a reasonable conversation about socialism and Marxism, its strengths and its weaknesses, has been virtually impossible in the United States. I'm going to give you an example from my own life, just because that's what I know best. I'm an economics professor. I got my PhD in economics, so I've been a professor in economics departments in the United States. For those of you that are not familiar with it, the socialist tradition, the Marxist tradition, has a long history of work in economics. Marx himself was a philosopher, he was many things, but he was certainly an economist among his achievements. And his major book, Das Kapital, is a work of economic theory. Given that, here's the remarkable thing. I have a PhD in economics from Yale University. I have a master's degree in economics from Yale University. I also have a master's degree in economics from Stanford University and a bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard University. I am a joke. I am an elitist joke. It's all true. I didn't make this up. I'd get into trouble if I made something like that up. So I didn't make it up. I was never required to read one word of Karl Marx for all those degrees. I mean, what else can I say to you? That's stupefying. That is so silly, so childish, so narrow, so frightened, that you really don't know where to begin. It's like meeting an adult human being who has never had a conversation with anybody on the subject of sex. What are you going to do? You don't know where to start. You're kind of defeated before you begin. You're awestruck. Your words fail you. What? That's how I feel. I meet with my colleagues, professors of economics that I went to school with, that are teaching with me. I know all they do because I had to learn that. But when I start talking about what I'm interested in from the Marxian perspective, they look at me as if I just switched to Urdu. And I don't speak Urdu. And they don't understand it either. But that's the kind of conversation we have. 50 years in which you excluded them. I would say today, and I'm being generous, I don't believe 5% of the American colleges and universities have anyone currently teaching who either teaches on this subject or knows anything about the subject. I don't think 5%. My guess is 1% do. That means the overwhelming majority have never been exposed to any sustained introduction whatsoever to the economics of Marxism, which are very close to, not identical to, but close to the economics of socialism, communism, and all the rest. That is a reality. We have to deal with that in this country. So one of the key things about the struggle between capitalism and socialism right now in the United States is that we have to make up for 50 lost years. It's almost like a person who was arrested for a crime he or she didn't do and put away for God knows how many years and then comes out and, kind of has to rediscover a world that's radically different from what it was when they went in. We have to discover how you talk to a fellow citizen if you're interested, how you study it yourself, How are you going to do that? How are you going to catch up? And I mean those of us here, too, who are sympathetic, I assume. If you find all of this distasteful, you probably went to the wrong church this evening. This just evening. So we're going to have to figure that out. And part of what you see people like me doing when we're on Fox TV or anywhere else is we're groping around trying to figure out how do we do this? How do we re-galvanize the interest, feed it? People used to say to folks like me, is it sad that you don't have many students? And I remember explaining to them, every year I've ever taught in the United States, I've had more students than I can handle. There never was a problem with the students. Not in the 60s, not in the 70s, not in the 80s, and not now. No problem with students. They're interested, they want to learn. They may be a little nervous, they may be a little skeptical, sure, and that's fine. It's good for students to be skeptical, whatever they're learning. But we've never had a problem with students. It's always with the larger society that's making it impossible for those students to sustain an interest. Students are taken aside, my students, and told by other faculty who don't mean me any harm, that, you know, for your career, it's not a good idea to do that sort of thing. Do this instead. Study statistics. No one's going to get angry at your politics for statistics. They don't understand what you're saying anyway, and it doesn't matter. Who cares? And you can get a good job, you'll get paid, you'll have a station wagon and two dogs. So they don't come. But having students was never a problem. So the first thing I want you to kind of get at is there's an immense learning process that has to unfold now. You can see it already underway. The interest is there, like the students were always there. The interest is there. But what has changed in America is that the larger atmosphere makes that interest okay. There's even a generational twist to this. As younger people, listening to their parents' generation poo-poo all this, are even more interested precisely because of that. It's like the parents, you must not go in that room. That room becomes so attractive, you can't hold on to yourself. I had this moment I will give you as a story because it articulates the situation. I was giving a talk somewhere in the Midwest, and it was some years ago now, and I came to the part about socialism, and I finished, and a couple of hands shot up, and a young man who looked very nervous stood up, and I was sure that I was going to get one of those responses that I was used to from years ago. I would give a talk on some subject having to do with socialism or communism, and I would finish, and up would stand someone who wanted me to say bad things about Stalin. And I would try to explain, yes, there's terrible things about Stalin, but it's not relevant to what I just spent an hour talking to you about. Could we talk about that? He would sit down, another person would get up and say, what about the Stalin? Oh, no. And I would have then to spend a lot of time talking about something I wasn't prepared for and wasn't really germane to what I was trying to get across, because people had been trained, socialism, Marxism, Stalin, murder, awful, awful, awful. And the basic question they were asking me is, you seem like a nice guy, how come you're talking awful? And I would have to say something which was this subtle equivalent of, I'm not awful. which sounds as lame as it is, you know? That was no fun for me. So I do my talk, and the young man stands up, and I thought, oh no, one of these, because he had that little nervousness that you get if you're going to give a talk. And it was being videoed, so there was light on the young man. And he started talking, and I realized he wasn't asking that question at all. He was basically saying, he danced around it, but his basic question was, very honest, what is socialism? He had no idea. But he knew enough to know that by asking me, he's asking somebody who's now going to give him a not awful story. I realized in that moment that the world had changed in this country, that these young people, they really didn't know, and they would like to know. It was wonderful. I then proceeded to give a glowing description of socialism, in the hopes that he would find it attractive, which he seemed to do. That's where we are. We are now, and by the way, who gets the credit for this change of mentality in America? Capitalism gets the credit. Capitalism is our best organizer, second only to Donald Trump, to whom I now give the thanks that he deserves for irritating, outraging people who become therefore willing to consider all kinds of people and thoughts they would have before thought come they shouldn't maybe pursue, but they are very important. And the next point about capitalism and socialism follows. Suppose you ask the simple question, what is socialism? Or for that matter, what is Marxism? The best answer I ever heard is the one I'll give you now. It is capitalism's shadow. You know the old fairy tales about trying to get rid of your shadow? There were various characters, little children's book about an animal that tries to get rid of its shadow, and you teach the child, you can't do that. The shadow is part of you. You can't shake the shadow. Socialism and capitalism have always been the institution and its irremovable shadow. Nothing guarantees the future of socialism as much as capitalism. They are each other's twins. The notion that you're going to get rid of that frightening shadow makes as little sense in the relationship between capitalism and socialism as it makes in your attempt to get rid of your shadow when there's light in the world. You can't do it. Capitalism produced socialism. Karl Marx, who still gets the respect he deserves because he was the greatest theoretician, not the only one, he's not enough, but he's something around which you kind of have to wrap your head, because not to is to make a fire by rubbing sticks together when there are matches available. You know, use Marx. He did a lot of work based on a lot of people. Not to study him is childish. It's just ignorance compounded with malevolence. Marx begins his life enamored of the French Revolution. He's a young German thinker for whom the French Revolution is the liberation of the human experience, the end of feudalism, the end of the Dark Ages, the medieval time. It is the breaking out of the power of religion. Because if you know about the French Revolution, it was very heavily anti-clerical, anti the Catholic Church, which was wrapped up with the feudal lords. Marx loved it, like all the people of his generation. Those of you who cherish the music, say, of Beethoven. This is the music of the celebration of the French Revolution in music. Marx is that in theory, in philosophy. He loves it. And the French Revolution is not only the end of feudalism and the establishment of capitalism, but it's the end of feudalism and the establishment of capitalism wrapped up in the idea liberty, equality, fraternity. The slogans of the French Revolution. So it's a change from feudalism to capitalism, but it calls itself a change from slavery to freedom, from the isolated human being to the celebration of us together. If you've never heard, really, if you've never heard the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, the final chorale section, the Ode to Joy, as a horrible translation from the German, but nonetheless, it is listen to it. It has this kind of triumphant movement of the world entering the realm of human freedom in all of its beauty. It's a spectacular piece of music. But that's Marx. He's doing the same excitement. And as he grows older, he's born in 1818, so the revolution's already 20, 25 years behind him. As he becomes mature and looks around, he has an epiphany, if you like. He looks around the capitalism of his time. Remember, he lives in Western Germany. He's familiar with what's going on in France and England, because those are the advanced countries of his time. So he's caught up in the intellectual life of his time, but he looks around at the capitalism. And the epiphany is, he says, wait a minute. The French Revolution was successful. It got rid of feudalism. It replaced it with capitalism. But the promise was that this transition from feudalism to capitalism would bring with it human freedom, liberty, equality, fraternity of all people. And as I look around, he says, to Germany, France, and England, the most developed capitalist countries of his time, he didn't see liberty, equality, or fraternity. He saw a rigidly class-defined and divided society. He felt, like those of his generation, that the revolutionary hopes of for the French had been betrayed, that the people of the world had gotten capitalism, and that the promise that capitalism would bring liberty, equality, and fraternity was false. And he set himself the task as an individual to explain why. Why did this happen? Why were we betrayed? Why did everything we hoped for not come to pass? And so he studies capitalism to get the answer. What is it, he says, about capitalism? And his conclusion is that capitalism is not the engine for liberty, equality, and fraternity. It's the obstacle. It, not some outside force, not some other thing, it itself precludes the very things it promised it would deliver. And then he reasons his way to come to this basic conclusion. Past societies, slavery, feudalism, were characterized by a tiny group of people who ran the show at the top, the masters, and an army of people who were the slaves and did the work. Or they were, in feudalism, the few, the lords, and the mass of the serfs who did the work. Capitalism was supposed to be the end of all of that. But it isn't. Because if you study capitalism, you discover a tiny group of people called employers running the show for a mass of people who are employees. No wonder they couldn't bring liberty, equality, fraternity, because in the core of the society, the production of the goods and services without which we can't live, food, clothing, shelter, all of that, right there in the organization of production, there's a tiny group of people, the board of directors, the big capitalist, the owner, whatever you want to call them, and a mass of people who come to work and do the work 9 to 5, 5 days a week until they retire, get a watch, and drop dead. Or in a different order sometimes. There are people who come after you die, put the watch on just so they're complete. So he's angry, Mr. Marx. If you read his stuff, you'll see the man is angry. He's betrayed. But he has a creative side to him. He doesn't want to just stay with the anger. He wants the anger to have a form that will make other people see what he has seen, to take their vague sense of being betrayed and turn it into an understanding of what the problem is and hopefully an active commitment to changing it. So he writes books, gives speeches, tries to convey what he figured out to everybody else. And socialism has always been that. The desire, the conviction, the assumption, and I'll say it as dramatically as I know how, that you look around capitalism and you have got to believe that we can do better than this as a human race, because if you didn't believe it, you'd probably jump off a bridge. You've got to believe, and most of you do, maybe all of you do somewhere, but you've got to let that little bird fly. You've got to say, oh yeah, we can do better. I'm sorry, I know it sounds like Obama's yes we can, I didn't plan that, but we can do better. We can do better than, and the impulse of socialism has always been there.
You're listening to Richard Wolff on Capitalism versus Socialism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Final points on this. What is socialism? Because we're really at the beginning. The answer is socialism is many things. And don't let anyone, including me, ever leave you with the impression that there is socialism. The remarkable thing about socialist ideas and Marxist ideas, and they're not the same. They're a big overlap, but they're not the same. But the remarkable thing about both of them is that from the early to the middle part of the 19th century, which is not very old, socialism and Marxism spread in a way faster and more global than any other comparable way of thinking across the planet. You compare the spread of Marxism with the spread of Christianity or Islam or any of the other global movements that started from somewhere and spread, then Marxism and socialism are stunning. They spread to every corner of the planet in less than a century. Anything, any social movement, any way of thinking that spreads to so many different places in so short a time, involving people in such different cultures and religions and levels of economic life and family structure, is going to, of course, be interpreted differently by these people shaped by their circumstances. So, of course, there are lots of Marxisms and lots of socialisms. One of the first things you can understand is if you are in the presence of a person who starts talking about socialism and Marxism as if it's in the singular, talk to somebody else. Because that person is either ignorant or trying to hustle you into believing that whatever it is they think it is the only way one could or should think about it. That's not true. I wish it weren't that way. It'd be really nice if there was a place you could go and this is it. Or if there was an agency that said, this is correct, this is wrong, this is the right one. Yeah, there is no such agency. For a short time, after the Russian Revolution in 1917, very short time, there was such an agency. The Russians were the first Marxists to actually pull it off. They made a revolution, 1917. Nobody could believe it. Up until then, socialists had tried, but they had never been able to kind of take over. They had tried, but they hadn't worked. They had tried with violent revolution. They had tried with electoral strategies. Some countries, they went quite far. Germany was the best, Austria. But they never quite... The Russians were the first ones. And so they got an unbelievable loyalty. Everyone around the world who had begun to figure out what socialism was said, of course, they must have the magic recipe because they did it. They're in charge. So for a short time, whatever they said Marxism was, everybody said, that's it. And people who said, no, I don't see it that way, were immediately branded as something evil. You know, the split between socialists and communists didn't exist until after the Russian Revolution. There were no such things as communist parties. Let me say that again so you all understand. Before the Russian Revolution, everybody was a socialist. But after the Russian Revolution, because of the enormous respect that Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin got as the leaders of this thing, the ones who actually won, I mean, some of you are looking at me. Why are we all interested in Bernie Sanders? Because he did so well. Other than that, he would have been a strange old man from a state that has more cows than people. Right? We wouldn't have taken him seriously. But he did it. He showed us that a person with the name socialist attached to himself can actually get millions of votes in America, which is very important for us to see. But try to keep that in your mind. When Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky emerged from the chaos of World War I in charge of what is the largest land mass country on this planet, Russia is bigger by geography than any other country in the world, people were flabbergasted. And so after the war, socialists split. Those who thought we have to do exactly what these guys tell us because they know how to do it, they did it. But there were a lot of other people who didn't agree with this or that, and they split. And the ones who didn't agree kept the old name socialist. And the ones who wanted to be loyal to the Soviet Union as the great leader took a different name to underscore their difference from the others, and that's when the Communist Party began. Communist Party all over the world starts in 1919, 1920, 1921, the years immediately after the Russian Revolution. Otherwise, there is no. And that was the issue for them. The Soviet, well, you have to get all of this, because if you don't understand that, you don't understand the history that will now flow. The communists and the socialists were angry at each other because they disagreed about this. Loyalty to the Soviet Union became a crucial part of the history. That's why China lines up with Moscow until they have their split in 1960. That's the history of this. We all have to learn that again, not the details, but to have a sense of what it is. What were the issues? The Russians and the socialists disagreed. The Russians thought the government should own and operate everything. The socialists said that's not necessary. In Germany, there's a terrible struggle going on right now. They're having a terrible problem. It may cost Mrs. Merkel her election. Here's the problem. Their biggest industry is the producer of automobiles. VW, Mercedes-Benz, all of that. Those companies, over the last 10 years, have violated every single norm of decent behavior you could ask of any corporation. They have stolen money. They have faked their emissions control so that they've polluted the air with millions of cars that they deliberately phonied and have admitted to this. I'm not making any of this up. And they're the biggest employer, and they're the richest, and they were abetted at every point by the political structure of what? Of the Christian Democratic Union, that's Merkel's party that runs Germany, but also of their governing party, the SPD, which is German for Sozialistische Partei Deutschland, the German Socialist Party, which is a partner with her. That partnership was really rocked when a leading German official of the Socialist Party, named Wein in Saxony, a very important part of Germany, was caught out by a newspaper having given this parliamentary speech he made about the automobile companies and what should be done to make them behave properly. Before he read it in parliament, he had given it to the executives at VW to look over it to see if it was okay. You couldn't have had a more slavish behavior of a socialist, because in that country, socialism means the government controls things to make capitalism a little less harsh than it might otherwise be. For them, that's what socialism is. Communism is some evil excess that they don't want to have anything to do with. We're going to have to relearn just the broad outlines of that so that we can what? Come up with a socialism, something better than capitalism, some way to organize society differently. In order to do that, we have to go through the effort of understanding where we've been as a movement, even though it's been repressed in this country. It hasn't everywhere else. Every European country, you talk to people, they know the difference between a socialist and a communist because it's part of their life, and it has been for 50 years. Only Americans don't get that. Think that this is an argument about how you spell something instead of an article of substance. Last, very last point, I promise. Key to all of it, from my perspective, is Marx's insistence in Capital and that of the people that have followed him since, that you're not going to change a society in the direction of liberty, equality, fraternity, freedom, democracy, and all of that, unless you put that at the base of society in the place where most adults spend their lives, at work. And it's probably also true, although Marx didn't go at it, that you also have to transform the other place people spend most of their life besides work, and that's the household and the family. You have to change those institutions, because if you don't, all the other changes you make will be brought back to where they were because you've not transformed the work relationships and the interpersonal relationships of a home. And that's the biggest problem that socialism has to face, how to conceive that, how to present that as a route to a really different society. But the help we will have doing it is that the existing society is falling apart. There's no nice way to say it, but you already know it. All I'm doing is putting it into words, which may be something that frightens you a bit, which I understand, frightens me when I hear myself say it. It's over. It's over. We had a good run. Capitalism did nicely. 200-300 years. We are on the other side of the hill. We are going down. That's why the governor of Arkansas is excited to have 400 jobs paying $14 to $15 an hour for his people. That's called a low bar. Really low. As I say, I could give you many more examples, but I thought Arkansas and Massachusetts, being so different in many other ways, have this exact same story. The only difference is in Massachusetts, it's an American company. In Arkansas, it's a Chinese company. A road was built for Amazon. It's called, of course, when a road is built, it's the state of Massachusetts that used taxpayer money to do that in conjunction with Fall River. It is called, and I want your hearts to beat, Innovation Way. That's the name of the road. You can't make this stuff up. These people live in a world like that. Innovation Way. It's designed for Amazon-bound trucks. Starting pay at the Amazon warehouse, hold on to your hats, folks, is $12.75 an hour, no degree required. There's one better than this. For junior inventory clerks. If that sounds like crap, I assure you, it is. For a junior inventory clerk with warehousing experience, the pay is $14.70 an hour, and it requires a bachelor's degree from a college. That's America. You go to college for 4 years, rack up $50,000 in debts, graduate, and you can work in a warehouse for $14.70 an hour. After you pay taxes, you could probably, for each hour you work, get 3/4 of a latte at the local coffee shop if they have a sale on lattes. Some of the jobs will be temporary hires through a company called, get ready, Integrity Staffing. Integrity Staffing, and you will pass along Innovation Way to your job. Yeah, we used to make fun of Eastern European countries who had a big picture of Lenin or Stalin on your way to work. Oh, look at that. We have Innovation Way and Integrity Staffing. The job description in Integrity Staffing, oh, by the way, this story comes from Forbes magazine. By the way, Forbes magazine has a title it gives itself. I don't know if any of you noticed. Capitalist Tool, which has a brilliant applicability if you think about it. They are very pro-capitalist. So that's where this story comes from. The Forbes magazine, August 4th. And you'll see where the story is going when I read you the title of the story. Quote, China-like wages are now part of the U.S. employment boom. Forbes magazine notices China-like wages. You used to have to watch, modern geography TV shows to learn about people living at the standard of living in China. You don't have to watch TV anymore, Forbes is telling us. I'm going to get to that. The job description from one of the temp jobs at the Amazon Center that are provided through Integrity Staffing pays $12.70 an hour, but it requires the ability, I'm quoting now, to stand for 10 to 12 hours straight in a fulfillment center where the temperature will occasionally exceed 90 degrees. $12.75, you will get cooked. No extra charge. Then the writer for Forbes does a little math. He says a lot of the people here don't get full time. They get 30 hours a week. They don't get 40. Well, he says, let's do the math. If you got $15 an hour, which many of them don't get that much, but if you got $15 an hour, that's $450 per week gross, $1,800 a month, less than $22,000 a year in your annual salary. If you got 40 hours, which many of them don't, you'd get $28,000 before taxes. You are therefore going to be poor all of your life. That's making America great again, because that's the success. When you bring jobs to Fall River, Massachusetts, and for Fall River you could substitute 50,000 other places in this country, working very hard to bring them in. They also got subsidies, Amazon, for coming there, money that the state now can't spend on schools or hospitals, roads or anything else, given to Amazon so that the people there can have a job for $12, $13, and $14 an hour. And then the story really hits its stride. He said, this is remarkable, he said. The lowest paid worker in that warehouse, assuming 30 hours per week, and there are plenty of those, would earn around, as I told you, $18,000 annually, or roughly $7,000 more than the median Chinese worker now earns. Ooh. If you earned $14.75 an hour working 30 hours a week, you would be earning $442.50 versus the median wage in Beijing, China, which is $329. Not that far behind, are we? We're not talking anymore America rich, the Chinese poor. That's over. They're catching up fast. Because American workers' wages, in case you hadn't noticed, is going absolutely nowhere. Flatter than a pancake, American wages, for 40 years. Meanwhile, the Chinese wages are going up and up very fast. So it's only a matter of time. And what Kenneth Rapuza, who wrote the article, what he's basically telling us is they're about there. They're about ready to cross the line. And he goes on. He says, a one-bedroom apartment in Fall River currently costs $1,000 a month. Now, I know for those of you in New York, this sounds like the bargain of the century, but it's Fall River. Believe me, the distance culturally and so on between Fall River and Manhattan is beyond your comprehension. I don't mean anything hostile to Fall River. I've been there a bunch of times, but it's not New York. $1,000 a month for a one-bedroom apartment in Fall River. A one-bedroom apartment in Beijing, China currently costs $930 a month. It's the same. The difference between the United States working class and the Chinese is disappearing. That's why the article is titled China-like wages now part of U.S. employment boom. We are having an employment boom, and the meaning of it is we're going to be living in the standard of living that the Chinese have now acquired. What's this? What's going on here? Just so you understand, there is no return to the golden age of manufacturing that Mr. Trump promises. One of the reasons it isn't happening is those jobs don't exist anymore. It's not that they don't exist here. They don't exist, period. They're done. The technology has been developed precisely to get rid of those jobs and those workers and those levels of pay. That's why it's possible to have machines that will produce in Arkansas 800,000 t-shirts a day for the Adidas Corporation. What is going on is the following. When China becomes part of the world economy, and it's not just China, but I'm going to use China as an example because they're the major part of this story. When the Chinese enter the world economy, which is really only about 20 years ago, they bring with them hundreds of millions of workers who are now eligible, in a sense, to go to work producing what everybody else is producing in the world. And that gives capitalists everywhere an incredible power, because they're the ones who buy workers, who buy labor. And suddenly the supply of labor has gone through the roof, but the buyers are the same ones that were there before. It's a buyer's market for workers. And when you have a buyer's market for workers, wages go nowhere or else down. And that's what happens. Chinese people are replacing everybody. That's why all the clothes you wear come from China, and your toaster does, and most of the interior of your automobile does, and your TV does, and all the rest. You know. You do know. So wages are going nowhere in the world. You either have your wages go down because the job leaves and there's too many of you left here in America competing for the few jobs, or you lose your job because a factory comes in and automates your job out of existence. And what we have now is the perfect storm. We have them both. First, we took our jobs and moved them out of a country. Now we bring them back, cheap labor. Americans so desperate that they have to work for $14 an hour in 90 degrees. And we have high technologies, only need very many of them. That means we're going to have a working class. That's what we're shaping up in this country, of unemployed people and people working at a level of suffering and a low pay and working conditions that are making us become what China was, what India was, what Brazil was, and what large parts of those countries still are. But the line of change is unmistakable. By the way, if I had more time, I would tell you that Amazon, which loves to say it's the biggest, it is not the biggest. It has a competitor. The biggest producer of delivery, the way Amazon does, is a company called Alibaba, which is run, it's a Chinese company, which is building huge warehouses that are centers faster than Amazon is all over the world. But there's a global struggle between Amazon and Alibaba, and from everything I can tell, Amazon is losing that particular struggle. And there's absolutely nothing that Mr. Trump or the government of the United States is doing to change any of this. The celebration of jobs coming here is the celebration of this process. Not the end of it, not the changing of it, but the celebration of it. We should be grateful that we have these jobs. The governor of Arkansas gleefully poses for pictures with the Chinese gentleman who must be laughing their way to the bank as they collect the millions from the people of Arkansas to bring them a collection of jobs that will make that area poverty-stricken for the foreseeable future. Either poverty-stricken with no jobs or poverty-stricken with jobs. Make America great again? You have got to be. The irony of it is so bitter that you can't even enjoy the humor. But it is the reality, and it's happening everywhere. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Wolff on Capitalism versus Socialism. He spoke in New York. Richard Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Chris Hedges, David Harvey, Angela Davis, Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, and Naomi Klein. And we have a series of programs with Richard Wolff. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. kronosquartet.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ricci is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Sonny Rollins, the legendary tenor saxophonist, performing Freedom Suite.